Hello everyone, this is David and this is Bali Peshi Kusab, or maybe in English, this is the threshold. So right now, I'm walking on the streets of the 8th district of Budapest and I'm heading to this conference that is organized by Sikra Movement and Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung. The name of the conference is Lab Left, or Laboratory Left. So this is a conference where movements, left-wing political organizations, unions and union organizers are going to share their knowledge and try to answer one really pressing question. How can we defeat centrists, neoliberals, and also right-wing and extreme right-wing political powers, governments, and how can we compete with their political organizations from the left? The organizers tried to set up an environment and create a platform for other organizers and organizations to share their knowledge and create this environment to share experiments on the different strategies and tactics in this struggle. You know, there is this saying that our generation was born too late to fight the big historic fights of the workers' movement, and we are born too early to see intergalactic socialism evolve. So in the meantime, what we can do is, and we can experiment with new ways of building up people power, new ways of gaining power. So I'm going to participate on this conference, but more importantly, I am going to try and make short interviews with people, organizers, practitioners, and activists. And surprisingly, this is going to be a great opportunity to do some follow-ups. Listeners of our podcast may remember the movement from Poland called Shoot. A bit longer than a year ago, Nora and I, we recorded a podcast with the members and leaders of the Shoot movement just after the Polish election, where the democratic opposition successfully defeated Kaczyński's right-wing party. Now I'm going to follow up on this conversation with Dominika Lasiota, one of the leaders of Shoot, and I'm going to ask her opinion on what happened in Poland in the last year and what does that teach for the left.
Az az ember, aki azt mondja, hogy nincs különbség bal és jobb oldal között, az jobb oldali. Én nem az ellenzék ellenzék, hanem az ellenzék lelkiismerete szeretnék lenni.
Megint úgy van, hogy olyan ember, aki nem cselekszik, állhat azon az állásponton, hogy az egész társadalom egy elvetendő valami.
Amikor a kapitalizmus világmérő bukására én sem látok rövid távon kilátást.
Miért tetszik lábjegyzetelni a saját életét? Miért nem tetszik átélni? Miért csak reflektál?
Now, before we jump into the discussions I had during this weekend on the conference, I wanted to give you a little bit of context. Although the panelists and presenters are all from all over Europe, there is still a more Eastern European focus here. I think it's partly because Sikra itself is from Hungary, a Central Eastern European country, and their eyes are on parties and organizations from similar situations as theirs. But it's also because there's a new generation of politicians and activists in the post-socialist region who were raised after the regime changes and have found ways to continue the struggle for workers' rights, women's rights, and emancipation. Eastern Europe is a trendsetter in Atlantic politics anyway. Viktor Orbán, the Prime Minister of Hungary, was among the first to consolidate his autocratic, conservative, and pro-capital regime after the decline of the liberal wave following the regime changes. His regime was and still is an example of similar leaders in Eastern Europe, but also beyond. It's enough to mention that one of his allies is newly elected US President Donald Trump. So, I will try to highlight this Eastern European element in the discussions. I talked to a politician from Croatia and two activists from the Polish Green and feminist movement. I did not mention this in the beginning, but I also moderated a panel with union organizers from Albania, Poland, and Hungary on this conference. I will leave some snippets of our discussions here from yesterday, because I strongly believe that their experiences are important and set an example for all left-wing organizers in this region. But first things first, let's start with the politician. One of the organizations that is represented in the conference is Možemo from Croatia. The politician I was talking with was Morin Živković, a member of the Zagreb City Council, a newly elected member of the Croatian Parliament. I wanted to know a bit more about Možemo, this party that has been formed in a merger of local activist groups and movements, so I started to ask about Morin's background before Možemo. Morin was involved in the party from the beginning. He joined the municipal movement Zagreb Jenaš, this party that was in the forefront of the 2021 local election in Zagreb, and eventually won the mayor's seat. That was their candidate, Tomislav Tomašević, who is still the current mayor of Zagreb. Morin also talked about the dilemmas of activists before forming Možemo. And at the end, he shared his thoughts on the chances of their mayor in the next municipal election. Here it is, my conversation with Morin.
My name is Marin Živković. I started my political path, let's say, as a student already, when we blockaded the whole university.
Oh, you were part of the Zagreb's university blockade?
Yeah, that's nice. Right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. We wanted free tuitions for every student, and so we started that movement. It was mainly on two colleges. One was the Philosophy Facultet, the Faculty of Philosophy, and the other part was on the Political Science department. That's where I was, and that was my first touch with politics, because at that moment when the world recession was starting, and people in Croatia were really struggling to pay the bills and so on. We found that that unjust way that the tuitions were set up was really not good for that social mobility and stuff like that. So that was my first kind of big contact, but I was already inclined to think about politics, because I was studying political science at the moment, and I was really interested from the early age in those things. And the second thing that was major at that time was a protest about Street Varshavska. It was a protest in Zagreb where a lot of core people from our movement came, where we defended one public square from privatization, from selling part of it to a private garage and so on. And there was a lot of corruption there, but a lot of people saw people that were involved in that as a kind of alternative to the current model. Then in 2017, we said, okay, this NGO life, this activist life, it doesn't really produce the results we want. The results are always subpar in a way. So we participated in the elections. We got one councilman in the local elections in Zagreb, and in the next elections, from just work of him and a couple of other people, it grew that we have a majority in the city, that we have a mayor, and that we are already 3 years in power, and it's going really good, and it's really transformative for the city, and let's hope that next elections will be even better.
So the party that you mentioned is Zagreb Jenaš.
It means Zagreb is ours.
Yes, and it started as a municipal movement, basically. That's collecting right. A lot of other movements, people from other movements and activists. Can you tell a bit about how you actually managed to come to an agreement that you have to enter politics together?
I think the main trigger was the government that was currently at that time in Zagreb. It was very corrupt. It was devastating our city, and there was no pathway to change it without entering politics. It wasn't the case that if we organize a protest, they will change their ways. It was so far gone that. So
you didn't have to like argue about it. Basically, you didn't really have to do the convincing.
No, we did. We
were arguing for years.
For years we were arguing because, to start a political organization, to go into that field, it requires a lot of time, a lot of financials, a lot of resources that we weren't sure that we have. And to move to that next step, you have to give up a lot. Our candidate for the mayor, he couldn't do his regular job and that also, you know. So and we also had all of us had our regular jobs, you know. So
yeah. So there was something you had to give up basically to serve the public.
Well, most of us had to do something additional.
Oh, yeah. It's not like, yeah, I'm not going this far, and for a couple of months I'm just going to live off of my, savings.
Yeah, we don't have trust funds and savings, yeah. Unfortunately, I think we are not that kind of a party. Yeah, so, but yeah, in the end, that was kind of like the core was founded on those two protests and the people who got frustrated. But before these elections we won, we also tried to involve as many citizens as we could. We started like online petitions for people to tell us what they want to change in the city. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who decided to fill in that petition joined us later, because we really engaged with people who wrote us. We met with them. We organized meetings in the places where they live. And in the end, a lot of those people accepted to be on our ballots to compete for the neighborhood councils and so on. And around 600 council people went into those neighborhood councils, which is a huge number.
Yeah, it's really impressive. Yeah.
After that, we didn't even force them like to join our party. I mean, a lot of them wanted to join, but we didn't want to grow with 600 new people that rapidly, because we found that that's a big risk. We had a city to manage at the same time.
And these are not just like members, but they are actual like people sitting in office, and they are council members.
They are council members, but it's kind of a volunteer position also. So it's not their job. It's like you do that like once per month. You have a meeting and you make some decisions. But you get some payment, but it's like 100 euros or something like that per month. So it's not a job, and even a city councilor position, it's not a job. It's also a volunteer position, which is crazy, because you decide on the budget of 2 billion euros or something like that, and you can check the budget after your work. Like, I guess it's fine. You know?
Yeah.
So, and that kind of system really, I mean, for the leading party, it's easy. It's easy because you have the whole administration that you have trust in. But if you're an opposition party, it's really a problem, and it's seen in the quality of discussion that they don't have resources to devote their whole time to
from opposition now.
Yeah.
So now they are in opposition.
Those
and they
that
don't
are
have
in opposition, I see in the quality of their arguments that they did it after work, you know.
Oh yeah. Or they don't sleep enough.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Something.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You won the election. You have a huge growth in your movement now. So you have to manage an organization and at the same time take over a government. And I know that this process of taking over the government and the local offices was painful.
Sure.
Because the previous government had their hands everywhere and really didn't want to give up their power. How did you manage to end that process? And my next question is going to be about what is going to come next.
Okay, so when we took power, the city was on the edge of bankruptcy. We weren't sure if we can pay the salaries of the people who were employed in the city. We had to take a short-term loan from one bank to even be able to pay the salaries. So it was really, really bad. But we somehow managed to get out of that debt. And we returned even some illegal debts 2 years earlier without cutting any social spending, even making some things cheaper, free for some people. We are building more kindergartens in Zagreb than ever, building public pools and stuff like that. So the city is really, really developing. We had a lot of opposition from the media for everything that we were doing, but our party is still kind of growing. So that's a positive sign. Our party development was on hold, I think, for 2 years. For 2 years, we were just handling the city, and the party was stagnating. Mm-hmm. But after that, we started to develop new rules, new organizations. We're just now conducting new elections for the neighborhoods. A lot of people are interested in that. We are choosing for each neighborhood. People that live in that neighborhood are choosing their own coordinators, which should bring some new energy to those neighborhoods. And some are old, some are new, but most of the decisions are kind of made with consensus. There is not really infighting about who is going to take charge, and the whole thing now is really with a lot of positive atmosphere that we are entering these elections stronger, more concise, and that we're going to hold that power and continue doing our policies that I think is the most important thing. Yeah,
my last question is exactly about this. So we have seen a lot of movements taking power, building on this huge burst of local people, disenchantment of the previous government or mayor, but holding to that power, maintaining power, and winning the next election is a big challenge. This question also have, of course, a relevancy now because there is going to be municipal elections. So the next election is going to be next March or April. So it's in the next 5 to 6 months. Can you talk a bit about what kind of guarantees you see in your mayors and local governments' previous 5 years for winning the next election as well? And what is your feeling about all of this right now?
Well, for start, I would like to explain the context. How come other left parties didn't manage to do the thing we did, so that we reduce the debts and didn't cut and broaden social spending. It was because we were lucky. We're not smarter. We are not better. We are not. We're just contextually in a better position at this moment. So a lot of new money was coming, and that really helped us to do it that way. So if the context was different, I don't know if that project would be successful like that.
You know.
So a lot of left parties that come to power usually come to power at the moment when there is a downhill trajectory, and on that wave of people not being happy how things are going, they take power. And then they cannot deliver what they promise because everything is going to shit. We, on the other hand, took power. It was going like that, but it wasn't going like that because of the some world trajectory or our country trajectory. It was it was very local, and it was going downhill because of the things local government was doing. So it was very different situation than other governments have. So we were lucky in that context. Our campaign will be that we are going to continue what we are doing, how we are doing, that we are involving citizens, that we are making new systems that are better in this and this ways, that we are all that we are doing is for those who have less, that we want to involve more people, that more services should be available to more people, and that will be our campaign. I don't know, it won't be something
like something surprising.
Yeah. So what the opposition, I think, will go for is that we didn't lower the taxes. Please. Taxes, the tax structure is taxing the rich more than it taxes the poor.
Mm-hmm. So it's progressive.
So it's an income tax that is... it put more weight on a richer part of the population, and we are using money to build services that mostly benefit those with lower income. So public transport benefits more those with lower income. More kindergartens, public kindergartens benefit more those with lower income, and so on and so on. So that's our agenda. We don't want to lower taxes to have less power to produce those services. We want those services, and we want to build on them and make them better and sustainable. So and they will go, yeah, but if people have more money, they, you know. So I think that will be the main issue, but I think it's a weak position of the opposition, because in a way you just have to show how much their salary will grow if if those tax cuts are made, you know.
So basically Mojemo has the advantage now that it actually delivered on the messages Tomasevic has promised and the whole campaign has promised in the previous election. So
With one caveat is that we wanted to close one landfill, the huge landfill that is in the city, and we didn't manage to do it in this 4 years. We assume it's going to be done by 2028, but we did promise it before the last elections, and that could be bad for us, in a sense that some people would say you didn't deliver on those promises. But there was also some context why we couldn't do that. But we really reduced or expanded our recycling in the city. We introduced new program that really motivated people to recycle more. And Zagreb was among the city with the biggest rise of recycling in Croatia. Will that be enough? We'll see. But I feel the enthusiasm of our people. They will be on the street. They will talk to people. And we are among rare parties that have such infrastructure in Zagreb that can be almost every day on the street in all the neighborhoods, not just in the center or affluent neighborhoods.
After my great discussion with Maureen from Croatia, Mojemo, I want to turn to the union organizers on the event. As I mentioned, I had this panel discussion with three organizers from Eastern Europe. Bora Mema from Albania, Maja Kudja from Poland, and Balázs Dvoráčko from Hungary. Bora from Albania is a member of a political movement called the Together Movement. Her background is in union organizing, and her union organizing is closely connected to her movement that I mentioned before. Maja, who is from Poland, is a member and organizer at the Polish Workers' Initiative. And Balázs, from Hungary, is an organizing secretary at the Forum of Union Cooperation, a Hungarian confederation of public workers' unions. So my question to them was similar to what I mentioned in the very beginning. There are specific challenges for leftist organizers in Eastern Europe because of historical reasons. I wanted to understand more, how do these challenges look like specifically when it comes to workers organizing? Let's start with Bora.
For the Eastern Europe I think we have some similar issues due to the fact that we have all been part of the Eastern Bloc and the so-called Soviet Bloc after the Second World War. And I assume, especially after 1991, everyone who wanted to organize in any kind of progressive socialist project was attacked as wanting to bring back communism, meaning that they want to bring back any kind of Stalinist system. And in our country, the context was even harder because we were not as the rest of the Eastern Europe bloc, where was a bit more liberal compared to the North Korea style that we had during Enver Hoxha's regime. So any kind of so-called even social democratic or progressive or even left liberal project was considered as a comeback to communism, to dictatorship. And we find that hard when we want to talk to workers, when we want to organize them in trade unions. They link that to dictatorship, to poverty, to isolation. And it's so damn hard to make people realize that that was not real communism, which I think it's sometimes a battle that we should not even debate about it in the sense of terminology, because that's not the right way, at least as we have seen when we are trying to organize workers on the field. These are one of the main challenges, but it's of course the fact that we have massive migration during the 90s. Albania was the first country in the Eastern Europe which met all the criteria by IMF and the World Bank to embrace all the Washington Consensus and everything. So we had massive privatizations and no public sectors and massive dismissal of workers. So it was so hard to organize in this context when everyone wants to escape from the prison somehow. Of course, it's also a country which is controlled by the organized crime. We have ministers who are linked directly to the drug trafficking and whose cars are being used for drug transports. So the judicial system is so highly corrupted, so that even the U.S. had to intervene to save the democracy and in the country. So yeah, it's so damn hard to even be a common citizen. Imagine trying to build a political project.
Now let's turn to Maya, who is going to explain to us how these challenges look like in Poland.
The problem that is connected with that is that the transformation of the system has been won by the unions that then has changed yellow. And so people have distrust in union, a huge distrust.
Sorry to intervene. Can you explain to the audience what yellow means?
Oh yeah, that's the kind of a union that really protects the interest of the employer, not the interest of the workers. So we have some unions that are some. For example, when you hire in Volkswagen in Poland, then you have a legal document, an umowa. Yeah, like a job document, and then the employer gives you a declaration to for a union. So they are, and it's a complete opposition. It's what unions are about. Some of the unions are in strict cooperation with the employers, and they're all about making money from the workers, paying their fees, and they're sharing the money with the employers. So this is how it ended up. But one of the other problems that I know, for example, in Italy, it's possible for organizers to enter the workplace and to hand out flyers, the external organizers. And in Poland, it's absolutely not possible. Now we have a new committee, a union committee in Auchan supermarkets, and I'm coordinating an action to give out flyers in Auchan's all around Poland, because that's a common employer and one corporation. So sometimes the security kicked us out of the supermarket, and yeah. But the strategy is to get as many people as possible and to occupy the exits, the workers' exits, and then hand out the flyers. Or there's also the rank and file strategy, which is basically about hiring yourself in the sectors that are crucial for gaining working class power. And a lot of activists that have joined our union have them then hired in Amazon to unionize more more successfully. And now we have around, I guess, 1,800 people in Amazons all over Poland, and it's growing bigger and bigger. And so we are, yeah, we're trying to push it through, even though there are some obstacles.
Later in our discussion, we talked a bit about our role as leftist activists, ideologically committed organizers in these workers' movements. Bora and Maya shared important insights when it comes to our roles in these organizations.
Which is also something else that I think that the left usually lacks. We talk a lot and we don't listen enough. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why working people do not vote for us, because we go as, and we preach and we never listen, when actually it should be at least 70% listening and trying to identify issues, trying to identify issues, not that we think that they are the right issues to win, or the right issues, or to overthrow capitalism, or to overthrow the government. Sometimes it can be something very basic, like a break in, or a extra microwave in the factory, or I don't know. There might seem like very small issues, but those are the issues that practically make people engage, give them confidence. They massively engage, and they should be widely spread, deeply felt. That motivates them and fuels anger, so people can engage, and also they can be perceived as something that can be won. And as time goes by and campaigns are built and more people engage, this is how you build class consciousness. And also, this is a political education which does not come from someone who sits here and preaches to people, but it comes in the organizing process. And one of the issues that a lot of people in the left have is that when they try to identify leaders, they identify people who are similar to them. And we had cases, I will share also a lot of mistakes that we have done. My comrades would identify people in the workplace who were more similar to us, who looked like comrades, or who were more feminist, or who were, had more a higher political awareness. And that's not the case. Usually there are people who are isolated in their communities, and sometimes the people who were organic leaders were very conservative. They were very religious, who would not be in the same mindset as us. But they are the ones who move their communities, and this is the ones that we should bring on board. And if they reflect, it's okay. If they don't, it's part of a struggle. So.
About finding the organic leaders, it's also what's very important is usually these are the people that have very direct interest in what we are fighting for. These are the people that are going to be the most persistent, because for them it's not a case of political views or ideology. It's about their life conditions. So they will stay the longest, from my experience. And organizing is also very important, and that's also about building coalitions with other groups, other social groups. Is that it's very, very important to oppose cancel culture in our organizations, and to not let disagreeing on some subjects let us argue with each other, because, you know, I used to be like that, and I used to push away some people for not being radical enough. But then I realized, okay, who has a real interest in that? It's the richest. You know, and we have a common enemy, and that is not a girl from another group that we don't like, but it's these are the richest, these are our landlords, these are our employers. And what organizing has taught me is that usually the higher class people would tend to push away people they don't agree with, because most of the workers, the warehouse workers, know that they are here for a clear cause. They want their working conditions to improve, period. And they don't don't care if somebody has voted for this party or this party, or somebody hasn't voted at all, or somebody supports LGBT people, or somebody else is homophobic. And for me, it's a very good attitude, because we're here for this, and we can disagree on other topics, but on the materialistic base subject, we do agree on, and we have to combine our fights. And that's what organizing is about for me.
Now, as you can hear from these testimonies, there are situations where activists are faced with a moral dilemma. In times of workers doing something that is morally not acceptable by certain left-wing standards, should activists keep going and focus on the economic struggle, or should they raise their voice? Bora Mema has shared a really personal story about a situation exactly like this. Now, I want you to hear this because I truly believe that the way she managed to overcome this situation can have strategic consequences on how we organize and set goals in our organizations.
I will give one example on when it comes to organizing. Then it was hard even for me personally to not to go through this kind of even when it, to this kind of self-confidence, when you feel like, is this a moment that I should step back or not, when it comes to, especially when you are a woman. It was when the most difficult campaign I ever had to engage was organizing in the mines, and especially organizing an electoral campaign when a minor wanted to run for independent MP, and I was supposed to coordinate it, and I was a woman, and 1 year and a half before I had to do this task, minors would not even shake my hand because I was a woman, and it's a town which is the poorest above the ground, although it's the richest underground, and people are in that specific region extremely poor and extremely religious and conservative. So I usually don't see women older than 12 or younger than 65 in the streets. That it's a man dominated. Even when you walk, you just see men in the streets. And imagine you're a woman, you're driving, you are from the city, you are not married. Why are you there? Like, people have all sorts of, imagine how suspicious, and all the conspiracy they read about you, that you are a foreign agent or a Soros paid or everything possible. And they think it might be true, because why is this woman here? And I had to adapt to the customs. When I'd sit in a coffee place, Raki, I think comrades from the Balkans know what it is. It's this typical alcohol that workers would drink. I'd sit and just have a tea to say that I'm a good woman. I don't drink alcohol, I'm just drinking tea, and I'm not smoking, and I took off my piercings, and I changed my outfits. I remember that I would go to the Zuma, to the Friday prayers, for the ones who know them, because it was the only place that I would see women collectively in the prayer. And I wouldn't lie, when they would ask me, are you Muslim? I'd be like, no, but I'm interested to learn, which it's not a real lie somehow, because I was interested to learn, but I was also interested to be in touch with them, to organize and to share leaflets, and I learned how to pray all the surahs. So you have to adapt to some kind of customs, and I find it quite repulsive when my ex-female feminist comrades would come and pretend that why isn't this enough a feminist campaign? Like, they've totally forgot that we are there to organize men, which happen to be conservative for several reasons. And we can't change without changing the structure, the economic structure of the whole country, at least. So I'll give a last example. It took, as I mentioned, 1 year and a half to be in touch with these miners and to get their trust. I had to wake up and be in the strike at 5 a.m., although it was minus 10, and stand there with them. And they would be quite surprised to see that a woman who is not even directly affected by the miners' condition is standing there. And so it took some time, but it was still it was not comfortable to go to the miners' places to sleep and eat and see how they treat their wives and their daughters. And it's always this this moment that you don't know if you should shut the hell up or you should react. But if you react, you know that you just pack and you leave and everything is doomed. So after some time, when we would have to sit in the dining table, there wouldn't be enough chairs for the women. And I would be like, can we find some other chairs in the neighbors? Or and the miner would be, no, my wife can eat later. Why should she eat? Why would she eat with us? Like there are enough chairs for enough people. Like he wouldn't even consider his wife to be one of the people to sit. And I didn't start a debate or a fight. And I said, oh, it's okay. Then I'll eat later with her because I want to have a chat about babies. I lied. I was not interested to have a chat about babies, but it was a way to show that I will sit with her. And he looked at me and he said, is this some kind of feminist ideas that you post on Facebook? And I'm like, no, I just want to talk with her. And the next time that I went for dinner, he went downstairs to his neighbor, picked a chair, and he brought it for his wife. When the electoral campaign was happening, he proposed his wife to be one of the observants. It might sound easy, but it's a woman who was going to be in the ballot box counting and having to have a fight in case the votes were going to be stolen from our from the ballot boxes. So, and I was shocked when I'm like, is Agnes your wife? I'm like, you're Agnes. And he's like, yeah, don't you think she's smart enough? I'm like, oh, imagine. I was shocked from the kind, and other wives of the miners have told us that since the strike started to happen, their husbands would invite them to go for a walk or to have a coffee or to come to the capital for a visit, something that they never did before. So I know these are not major changes, but it shows how during the class struggle, emancipatory processes happen, and not from top down, but when you see each other as equals.
I can say that this story felt really empowering in this situation. At the end, I think we all came to the conclusion that, yes, there are specific challenges, but this work that is being done by this new generation of leaders and organizers, it is really awarding a lot of the times. As a closing, Balázs shared with us his experience. He's been working on political education in the unions, part of his confederation, for years now. With education, they are trying to empower organizers, activists, and everyday workers all around Hungary. These people get their education and then go back to their workplaces and experience the successes that the organizing methods and tactics allow them to have in their own workplaces for their own lives. And these people send feedbacks to Balázs. And these feedbacks are the small energy bombs that keeps him and a lot of other people going in this sector.
These people start to believe and they just say, I can do it. I can. I have the tools, I have the knowledge that I can do it. A year ago, I wasn't able to do things like that, to manage issues, organize people, deal with my bosses. So just knock the door and go, hey, we have an issue and we have 15 people or 100 people behind me. There are the signatures. We have an issue. We have to solve it now. Let's do it. And they are surprised, wow, you have an issue? And 100 people is on the signature list. Oh, that can be a very, very serious issue. You need a new fridge in the restroom. Yes, can be solved. Thanks for coming. So easy like that. So these people are always giving us feedbacks, and this brings us over and over. And it means that if you have goals, if you have, if you believe in something, you have an ideological view. It's not spiritual or anything like that, but you can consider like this. There is hope in the society, and we might be able to change the society together. As Maya just mentioned, it doesn't matter that you vote. It matters to vote different parties, but we are all different. We have all different kind of views. But at the end, we have different subjects that we want to solve to make our life much easier and have a proper life, a quality life.
We have been silent enough. This was the slogan of the mobilization campaign of a local Polish organization called SUD. The group has published a video 2 weeks before the election last October, and this video dominated the public discourse for the last days of the campaign. The video played sound bites of right-wing politicians saying derogatory things to women and LGBTQ people, and ends with a powerful image of women saying they've had enough. Eventually, Donald Tusk's party coalition won the election. One of their most important promises was that they will legalize abortion as soon as possible. 1 year passed, and there is still no significant changes in this regard. Abortion is still widely inaccessible in Poland. Here, I have Dominika and Nadia, two activists of SUD, talking about their experiences after the election.
So nice to see you here in person.
Yeah.
I mean, listeners might remember that not longer than a year ago, Dominika was also already a guest on our podcast. And now we have a new colleague, friend, activist from SUD, which is, I think, the right pronunciation.
Yes, SUD.
Yes.
The sunrise.
Okay. I'm just
sunrise
like
east.
And I thought that it's a nice opportunity to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Because last time, our discussion, I think it was the optimism was over the roof.
Yeah.
And of course, even in Hungary, progressives watching Poland, I think a lot of us felt that this is the future we never had.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious what happened after. I'm really curious what happened after this whole euphoria. And how did the hangover look like after the election?
I remember this video of Doma just crying, like being like.
I remember it too, unfortunately.
Yeah, like crying, like being like, yeah, they won. But like, for me personally, I was counting the votes, so I was really tired, and just wanted to go to sleep, so I didn't feel the euphoria as much at the moment. But there was this sense like, yeah, well, like we did it, and now we can actually make some changes.
Yeah, well, but that turned out to be much more complicated than we thought.
Yeah.
And I feel like looking back, that euphoria was absolutely valid, and because we did achieve something unimaginable, something that seemed impossible to do just even like months before the elections. But right now I know that we were unprepared for what would come after. Like, we were so focused on getting the bastards out that we were not prepared to actually like make the change real once the better ones, let's say, are in the office. And this year was really a year of us being lost, us being confused, us being extremely disappointed with what came after. But I think that the most important thing is that this year for us was the year we realized that if we might have opened for ourselves the doors for things to change in Poland, but to make that change real, like, we will have to put in so much work. And that the even the better ones in office will not deliver it like that. Like, it's not going to happen automatically, because there are still way too many boomers in the parliament, way too many corrupted politicians out there, way too much of the influence of big business, and the fight. We realized the fight would just be so much bigger than what we thought. But I feel like we now, after a year of confusion, we now understand what's ahead of us, and that gives me a lot of hope.
Two of the most important topics or issues that you've been campaigning on were climate and women's rights. And the work that you've been doing and other organizations, activists and common people have been doing on these two issues have pushed the Tusk's campaign to the movement's direction a bit, at least in the promises. Mm-hmm. How do you see these two topics now, 1 year in retrospect? Has there been any progress in either climate or women's rights?
Well, honestly, I feel like there was no progress. Like, besides for like women's rights and reproduction rights, like there was like this one win with the in vitro. So that's the thing. But like for the, for example, abortion, which I feel like these elections were pretty much about the abortion, right? So it took the new government a few months to even bring the bill into the parliament. And then it was like, I think it's still being worked on. And the main argument of the government is that we have a president from like the current government.
Previous.
And I feel like it's so stupid, because with the presidential elections coming, they could like gain so much recognition from the people that they are trying to do this, but this president from Law and Justice doesn't want to do it. So it's like, they have a lot to gain, but the thing is, they don't want to change the law. Like the head of the parliament refuses to say like clearly what his stance on abortion is. His party pushed really hard for referendum, which didn't happen in the end. And yeah, and they like basically said, like, without any, I don't know, like they clearly said that there will not be an accessible abortion with this government.
Yeah, which is crazy to think.
Yeah.
So I think one of the important voices that we've heard throughout this year was from one expert in our civil society, who said that there has been a change in aesthetics of the governing, but not the change of actually like the matter, the politics. And I feel that it's so on point, because, you know, we've seen Donald Tusk, our new prime minister, smiling and saying that like democracy is safe now and we've like secured the freedom, da, da, da. But it actually, like, when it comes to like concrete changes, concrete policy, nothing. Silence, or you know, the boomers just still like replicating what the previous right-wing government was doing. And when it comes to the climate, it's very similar to women's rights, like, but it's less heated, there's less debate on it. But, you know, where the state-owned energy companies are investing in fossil fuel deals the same way the previous one, like the previous team was doing. The climate policy, there is a change in like strategic documents that is being worked out, and there is some progress happening, and I very much appreciate that. But, you know, that goes to the same point that we're saying, that like this new government is not representing the courage, the resilience, the boldness that is required to meet the crises that we're facing. And it really is for us to actually bring it into the political scene, because otherwise, you know, like Donald Tusk cannot count on the voters that got him to the office for them to do the same thing in a few years. Like, if you do not deliver the transformation, these people will just stay at home. And so I think that this new governing coalition is very naive in what they're doing, very, you know, just very stupid, to be frank. But I guess, you know, our task is just to continue the fight, to continue confronting the better ones, just the same way we did with the right-wing coalition, and really like fighting hard as hell to get these concrete changes in place.
And I think talking about the next elections, which are going to be like in 3 years now, I think about what happened in the USA, where there was like this, there were Trump, then Biden, and then there's Trump again. And you would think that our current government, who lost once already with the Law and Justice 8 years ago, would learn now that if you want people to vote for you, if you want to win, because I don't really think that this government is interested in making lives of people better, but I think they're interested in winning. Mm-hmm. So if you want to win, you have to deliver,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, the failure and the betrayal that the liberals represent is the biggest tool that helps fascists enter spaces of power. If this new democratic, let's say, coalition doesn't deliver, like, we will see far-righters coming back sooner than we think. And so, like, what is at stake is extreme. The stakes are massive.
And when it comes to social movements like yours, do you feel it's easier to fight for your goals under the new government than it was before?
I think definitely, like, a big, big danger and a big challenge with the government before was that there was a complete, like, blockade from them when it comes to any sort of dialogue. There was no dialogue at all, no debate. We would debate all those things and those demands in, like, our circles, but, like, they were completely shutting themselves away from this. And the second thing is that, like, the police violence, the infiltration systems were used so much more than with this government in power.
Against activists?
Against activists, against opposition parties, against civil society.
There was actually this situation that came out lately that the women's strike leaders were infiltrated,
like, by the tabbed, and so they
even they were tabbed in the Pegasus system that is sold from Israel, which is a fun fact, that was used against, you know, civil society leaders back in the day. Right now, apparently, we don't have that, and so, like, the conditions for campaigning are perhaps less violent than they were, but the people are less active than they were before, and that's a big, big challenge. And I think what we learned from these past few months is that we need to be very clear on what kind of transformation we want to see happen in Poland. And so we did that with working on our, let's say, like, visionary document called Plan for Generations. We brought the whole movement together and we, you know, put all of the demands, all of the dreams into this piece of paper that we are now, you know, building coalitions around. So that was important to identify, like, where do we want to go to? And we are starting, it feels like we're starting from scratch to build, you know, mass power, mass political, public support for what we want to see happen in Poland right now. And it is really challenging. So I would say that work is much, much more demanding than before. But I also feel like we are much clearer on where we want to get to. And we weren't clear on where we want to get to in under law and justice. We just wanted to get them out of office.
Yeah, and I think, like, it worked to our advantage before the elections that we had this, like, clear enemy. And everyone was like, yes, so we are against them. But now people are like, they are no longer in power. So what's the problem? And I think it's, like, with mobilizing people, but it's also with getting, like, media attention. So the media that in the last year wanted to talk about us are really, like, pro the current government. So they're not so interested in hearing the critique of them. And also our actions about the Palestine, it also made the media, like, angry with us or something. And they are like, well, we don't want to talk with you so much.
First of all, I think the conclusions that you made about how social movements have to accommodate themselves to this new political environment is really important. So I just wanted to highlight that because it's also really important for Hungarians as well. We might as well wake up in 2026 and find that Orbán is not our prime minister. So we have to prepare that, even if we are not going to achieve that vision. But what I wanted to ask is exactly what you have mentioned. I think Poland is really unique in a sense that that there is a massive grassroots movement that you are also a part of that it supports Palestine. And I think it's unique because it's rare to find these movements in Eastern Europe. And I wanted to ask, what is your experience? Who are the people you can mobilize? What are the reactions you get? Has it changed your place in the public?
Well, first of all, for the context, you know, 7th of October happened on the 7th of October. We had general parliamentary elections, the elections, on the 15th of October. So when all of, when the genocide of Gaza was unfolding, we were just at the end of our, you know, months-long or even years-long campaigning against the right-wing government. So at the very beginning of the genocide, we, you know, we were extremely just tired and really, obviously, happy with what we achieved, but we were exhausted and many of us just needed to kind of shut down. But it was hard to shut down when seeing all of the atrocities happening in Gaza. So I would say we needed a minute to catch our breath, but then the decision to start campaigning for Palestine felt like the most like natural, sensible thing to do. Like we just could not do it anyway. And I mean, in Poland, none of the established NGOs wanted to say anything about Palestine. It was a complete silence. And the only people that were doing something was the Palestinian, the Muslim, the pro-migration, pro-refugee groups in Poland. They started doing things, but it was very small. And, you know, it felt like they are fighting against this massive machine that doesn't want to move. But to us, you know, it kind of like just grew within our community, like that need to do something for Palestine. And looking back at this, I feel like it completely transformed the movement. As in like, you know, when we were campaigning against law and justice, we were branded as like the inspirational young people fighting for democracy and freedom. And then very quickly when we started doing Palestine, we were branded as terrorists, we were branded as like weirdos that do this like niche thing called anti-genocide campaigning. And so a lot of the allies that, you know, just a minute before were with us and were so grateful for what we've done, suddenly they would turn away. The media that loved us, suddenly they will, you know, wouldn't pick up the phone when we called them to invite them to a press conference under an action. And, you know, I feel like that seems very sad and like disappointing, but to be fair, looking back I am so grateful we did this, because I think it introduced to the movement a sort of like a new mindset for us, that, you know, sometimes we will be super popular and everybody will love us, and sometimes everybody will think we're freaks, we're terrorists, we're doing something that is wrong. But deep down, if we know that is right, we just have to stick to the cause. And it verified a lot of the things in the movement. It obviously made some people quit because they weren't on the same page. But I'm so grateful, because I really think Palestine transformed also what we've done.
Yeah, but you said that that some people quit, but also a lot of people,
yes,
came and are now organizing with us because of Palestine. So it also brought a lot of people. And to put it in even like broader context, I think it's really like the history of Poland and like the role it played in Holocaust, I think it's really important. And I feel like it should be this like the reason to really be anti this genocide, because we saw it once and we learn about it in schools. And
our ancestors, yeah, were also, you know, just annihilated in this genocide.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not such a long ago history, you know, and we have like all these museums and so. And well, I feel like I still don't understand how we as a nation, mm-hmm, who experienced such a thing as Holocaust can not bring ourselves to be like anti this next genocide that is happening right in front of our eyes.
See, even though every once in a while we manage to achieve historical successes, this, however, does not mean that the struggle stops. The struggle has to continue. I think that is one of the most important conclusions we can get out of these discussions here. But let me just end this episode on a different note. We tend to focus too much on examples from the West. For example, last time Nuri and I were talking about the US elections in depth. The reason is that that campaign dominated the public discourse for months in Eastern Europe, and the news of the possible members of the new administration still dominates the headlines here. But we should not look too far if we want to find hope for our own future. It is clear and evident now that there is a new generation of activists and a new generation of leaders here, right in front of us in Eastern Europe. So my question is this: if the right wing was able to set the trends in European politics 10 plus years ago from the same region, why shouldn't we? So, all eyes on them, all eyes on us. This was David from Belépési Küszöb. Take care. See you later.